Comfort, comfort, ye my people. For unto us a child is born, good news of great joy, the titles of Christ, the Magnificat. These are some of the Christmas card themes produced by Ad Crucem. Send a greeting card this Christmas season that's centered on the gospel of Jesus Christ. AdCrucem.com, confessing the faith through art and word. AdCrucem.com, AdCrucem.com.
No matter what we choose to believe, there's no God who condones taking the life of an innocent human being.
Where I think we are in the culture, but also with religious institutions, is that people have stopped hating us, that is to say LGBT people, but they're not yet ready to celebrate us. That's the next big work to do.
Maybe it's something as simple as you whistle while you work.
Just whistle while you work.
Mega churches are a house of cards. Mega churches really are the primary example of what's wrong with evangelicalism, why it's so thin, so insubstantial, so unsatisfying.
Southern Illinois truck drivers, love issues, etc.
I remember, and it wasn't that long ago when it was just one state. One state that approved same-sex unions. Do you remember that? It really wasn't that long ago. I don't think it was any more than about 10 years ago, maybe a little bit more than 10 years ago. Well, things have changed. Now we're talking about 30-plus states that have some form of same-sex marriage. And some people are saying it's a tipping point. And they're making a comparison. Now, you'll read about this in the New York Times recently. In fact, it was yesterday's New York Times. In same-sex marriage calculation, justices may see golden ratio, and the golden ratio that they're talking about is a tipping point of states where they say, you know, it's not necessarily the will of every legislature, of all the voters in every state, but it's the will of enough. And they may make a decision, some are speculating, like they did when they legalized interracial marriage in 1967 or struck interracial marriage. And say, look, it worked then, it'll work now. Is there a real comparison between the two, between interracial marriage and same-sex marriage? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Dr. Jennifer Oback-Morris will be our guest to talk about same-sex marriage and interracial marriage here for a few minutes. Then Pastor Richard Futrell will join us. We're going to talk about whether or not Christianity is a religion or a relationship. He says yes, both, but rightly understood. Adrienne Dorr-Hines will join us, managing editor of the Lutheran Witness. We'll talk about the danger of subjectivity. She says, and this should shock some people, might shock some people, she doesn't have to hear an opinion from a woman to form an opinion of her own as a woman. She's just as happy hearing opinions from men. Adrienne's kind of our anti-feminist in a lot of ways. We'll be talking to her. And then Dr. Hal Sinkbye will join us to talk about how we engage, and that's a tricky word, how we engage the culture without capitulating to the culture in the church. That's the lineup for today's Issues Etc. You can join us for the next 2 hours with questions or comments. Our call-in number 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Our in-studio email address is talkback@issuesetc.org. Our Twitter address at @issuesetc. Our beloved on-demand listeners can always use the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morris joins us to talk about same-sex marriage and interracial marriage. She's founding president of the Ruth Institute based in San Marcos, California. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities, and she's author of the books Smart Sex and Love in Economics. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Todd. Hey, I thought I was your anti-feminist around here. You hurt my feelings.
Oh,
there, man.
I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. We have several. I will give you the title of a senior anti-feminist, if you don't mind.
I'll accept that. That sounds great. I'll add that to my resume and use you as a reference.
All right. Happy to provide it. Here's a brief paragraph from the recent New York Times piece titled In Same-Sex Marriage Calculation, Justices May See Golden Ratio. In a brief urging the Supreme Court to hear a same-sex marriage case from Ohio, lawyers for several couples recited the history and pushed the comparison between same-sex marriage and interracial marriage. They say, the current landscape for marriage recognition for same-sex couples looks much the same as it did in 1967 for interracial couples and in 2003 for same-sex intimate partners. What do you make of the comparison?
Well, there are two things wrong with it. I mean, first of all, the change in the law and with respect to interracial marriage was all done by state legislatures and very little done by courts, whereas now it's all being done by courts. And the second thing that is completely different about it is that when the ban on interracial marriage was removed, it was going back to the way marriage had always been, which is that marriage had always been something that people could marry the opposite sex partner of their choice. You know, that race is not relevant to marriage. And so some states never, ever had a ban on interracial marriage. You know, so the racial feature that Jim Crow statutes imposed upon marriage in some places in the South, that racial feature was never essential to marriage. Nobody ever thought it was essential to marriage. So there's nothing comparable between the two kinds of cases. They were just restoring marriage to what it had always been prior to a Jim Crow type of regime, whereas what is being done with genderless marriage is to create something that has literally never existed.
What do you make of the kind of tipping point argument with respect to the court? That is, the court's really going to have to seriously consider the overturning all the bans on same-sex marriage in one fell swoop because it's reached kind of a critical mass in the states.
Yes, well courts in those other states have already done the work. Let us be honest, the Supreme Court itself in its Windsor decision overturning DOMA about 18 months ago, the Supreme Court has already put its thumb on the scale of providing language and argumentation as to why marriage should be a genderless institution. They've already done all the work. So the idea that this is some further tipping point, you know, I'm sure that makes them feel better. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if the Supreme Court justices do not feel what they're claiming here in the New York Times. But I'm not particularly impressed. They created that situation themselves, really.
Now, I wonder how you would describe it. It was not that long ago. I mean, 10 or 15 years ago, when no states had legal same-sex unions, much less legal same-sex marriage. How did we get from one to as many as we have now?
Yes, I was trying to think about that as you were talking. I want to say it was 2003 or 2004 that the Goodrich decision came down in Massachusetts. And right around the same time, Canada changed its marriage law. So I've forgotten the exact date, but it's right in that time frame. So it's right around 10 years, Todd. So, I mean, how has this happened? How is it possible that this has happened? Well, because there has been a well-financed, carefully orchestrated campaign to remove the gender requirement from marriage. That's all. That's what it means. It means the rich and powerful people of our country have decided we're having genderless marriage. Why they've decided that, that's a separate question. But I don't think there's any doubt that that's what's happened. It's not that ordinary people have already all of a sudden decided, I wonder if kids really need a mom and a dad. You know, let's think about that. No, that thought was put into their mind through careful campaigns, through politics, and through the entertainment media. And that's why we're looking at what we're looking at.
What do you think? I mean, I think most people are resigned to the fact that the Supreme Court has, at least in its slim majority, said, we want to hear this case. What do you think is likely to happen when they hear a case that would, in effect, be kind of the softball to knock down bans, constitutional otherwise, on same-sex marriage in the states?
Well, I'm loath to predict what courts are going to do because they surprised me before, you know, with what they chose to do. I know what I hope they'll do. I hope that they will not overturn the one institution we have in society that attaches children to their parents. I hope they will continue to affirm that biology is the principal way that we should be attaching children to their parents. The affirmation that gender is irrelevant to parenthood, or that gender is irrelevant to marriage, will eventually mean that gender is irrelevant to parenthood also. You know, if people don't get this, that redefining marriage will necessarily redefine parenthood. And as far as I'm concerned, we've already done way too much of that, with far too damaging results for us to just be rushing headlong off into another social experiment. So I know what I hope they'll do, but I have no idea what they're actually going to do.
Have the courts, to your way of looking at it, have they been willing to listen to that particular line of argumentation that that brings in the issue of the children?
You know, I think that in a lot of the cases, they haven't brought the argument forward as powerfully as I think it should be brought forward. In other words, there's a certain lawyers have their own mysterious ways of doing things, so I'm not always sure why they're making the arguments that they're making. And there's a particular proper legal form in which every argument needs to be presented, you know, so that it works to the best effect. But honestly, when I read these briefs, I feel like my argument is not really represented as well and as effectively as it ought to be. So that's something that we're thinking about over here at the Ruth Institute is, you know, whether or not we should be involved in the next case as an amicus. Because I think there are some things that need to be said that haven't been said as clearly as perhaps they should be.
So to me, the utility and the brilliance of that argument is that it avoids the issue of, well, in a sense, it avoids the issue of the morality of marriage, if you know what I mean. It avoids the issue of whether or not homosexuality is a moral issue. It avoids all those things, not because it doesn't want to deal with it, but because the real biological relationship that is forged by marriage is with parents and children. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, that's really what I'm talking about. You know, in other words, if you say, okay, here's something that two men can do and something two women can do and something that a man and a woman can do, I mean, are you going to call that marriage? I mean, what is that two men can do, two women can do, a man and a woman? It isn't even tennis. You can't even play. You can't even have tennis partners like that, you know? That gender is relevant for a lot of things, and it's certainly relevant for parenthood, you know? And so to have the government put its big old fat thumb on the scale and say to everybody in society, hey, you're all free men and women. You all get to do whatever you want. But we're telling you, as a matter of law, that men and women are interchangeable. As sex partners and as parents, men and women are interchangeable. And by the way, the biological relationship between children and parents is not particularly important. It's not something we particularly think we're committed to defending. Because after all, if two guys want to have a baby, we're here to help them make the legal arrangements that will make it possible for them to be legal parents of a baby together. The government starts talking to us like that. That's no longer a government that respects nature, that respects the human body, and that respects the reality of the biological connections between children and their parents. And that we've entered into a very new and different relationship between the parent and the child and between the citizen and the state here. And that's what I find so objectionable about the redefinition of marriage.
Finally, we're going to be sitting around with family during the Thanksgiving holiday, and this subject may come up. And, of course, there are always differences of opinion, but often the argument is stated kind of the reversal of the argument, which is, look, if you're in favor of banning same-sex marriage, you're just like those people who are in favor of banning interracial marriage. How should we respond when our family members toss that one across the table?
Well, I think first of all, if it's a family gathering, it's a person that you love, I think the first thing to do is to reaffirm your love for the person who's doing that because to verbally say it, to say, you know, look, you know, you're my uncle and I love you and I care about you. And that argument has been created by people who are not necessarily acting in good faith. And so I'd like to respond to your argument, but I want you to kind of let's tone down the accusation part of this, okay? Let's start with that. I think that should be addressed around the Thanksgiving table. But then I think the proper intellectual answer to the question is that, you know, first of all, gender is relevant to marriage in a way that race is simply not relevant to marriage. And second of all, I think that the essential public purpose of marriage is to attach mothers and fathers to their children and one another. Race does not, interracial marriage does not interfere with that in any way whatsoever. The people who created anti-miscegenation laws in Virginia and other states, those people knew perfectly well that Mr. and Mrs. Loving could participate in the public purpose of marriage. They knew perfectly well they could get married, have children, and take care of those children. They knew perfectly well that was possible. That's what they were afraid of. They didn't want all these mixed-race babies running around. You know, that was the point of the statute, was to prevent people from participating in marriage who were perfectly capable of doing so. And so now what's at stake is to really change and redefine the public purpose and public meaning of marriage so that it's no longer about attaching mothers and fathers to the children of one another. Now the public purpose of marriage is to have a public affirmation of people's affection for one another. And, you know, I just can't figure out why that's any of the government's business at all, to bless our friendships or to affirm us in our love or anything else like that. Matter of fact, I'm not really keen that the government should have any kind of position about love at all. I don't want them asking me, hey, do you really love this person? That's none of their business. And it's never been any of their business who loves who, you know? And that's what we're trying to turn the marriage institution into, to make it something that has not really been before, and to remove its essential public purpose. I think that's not a good thing to do.
Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse is founding president of the Ruth Institute based in San Marcos, California. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities. She has authored the books Smart Sex and Love in Economics. We will be posting a link to her blog and to the Ruth Institute website at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Jennifer, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to spend some time with Pastor Richard Futrell. He has written a great piece on religion and relationship. It's not a religion, but a relationship. Not quite. We'll talk about Christianity as religion or relationship, or perhaps, rightly understood, both. We'll be right back. Are you concerned that nativity scenes aren't being displayed in public places? Why not display one at your church or your home? The Outdoor Nativity Store produces durable, affordable, and American-made outdoor nativities for Christians around the world. To view a variety of nativity sets, visit OutdoorNativityStore.com. These nativities will hold up under the harshest weather conditions, snow, ice, and wind. The Outdoor Nativity Store. OutdoorNativityStore.com.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start. The foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House. Listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House. cph.org.
Talk radio for the Christian worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hey, St. Louis. How would you like to achieve your fitness goals in a fun and supportive atmosphere? Hi, this is Kevin Reisick, owner and operator of Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. We offer adult boot camps throughout the week. These camps include cardiovascular conditioning, muscular strength and endurance training, balance and coordination activities, and more. For more information, give me a call at 618-670-6952, Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois, 618-670-6952.
Organist Service, aptly abbreviated SOS, really has come to our rescue.
Pastor Jim Hollowatch of Christ Lutheran Church in Jackson, Mississippi.
With the ever-growing shortage of skilled musicians in our community, we were approaching a real crisis. But thanks to the Substitute Organist Service, help is always just minutes away. With its easy, intuitive interface, friendly customer service, and outstanding musicianship, you really couldn't ask for more.
You can find out more about the Substitute Organist Service at churchmusicsolutions.com.